We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Today, we have access to many different sources of news. And in addition to this explosive growth in sources, there has been a very dramatic increase in the speed with which information is disseminated. And that is a real challenge for people who are trying to stay on top of the news today. How do we decide what to believe and what sources to trust? That is the question. Those are the questions we'll try to take up this morning in this hour of Focus with two guests. And they're the authors of a newly published book. The title of the book is Blur: How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. It's published by Bloomsbury. And in this book, our guests, Bill Kovich and Tom Rosensteel, they make the argument that what these changes mean is that more of the responsibility for knowing what's true and what is not now rests with us as individuals. That, however, is something that you can work at, and they offer some tips, ways to think about that, and in the book. So we'll talk about that. We'll also try to talk a little bit about how media, the news business, is changing, and some of their ideas for what the business should be moving toward. All of that in this part of the show. Let me just introduce our guests a little bit here for you. Tom Rosensteel has been a journalist for more than 30 years. He was media critic for the Los Angeles Times, also chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek. In 1996, he founded the Project for Excellence in Journalism. That's a think tank that studies the press. It's part of the Pew Research Center in Washington. Bill Kovich has been chief of the New York Times Washington Bureau. He served as editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He directed the Nieman Fellowship Program at Harvard University. He's the founding chairman of the Committee of Concerned Journalists, and he is senior counselor for the Project for Excellence in Journalism. And they're both joining us this morning, and we're really pleased they could talk with us. Questions, of course, are welcome, as always. We hope people will stay on the topic and try to be brief. That'll help us include as many callers as possible. Certainly, people are welcome to join us. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you certainly should feel welcome to call. And Mr. Kovach, hello.
Hey, good morning.
And Tom Rosensteel, hello.
Hi, David. It's good to be back.
Well, I really appreciate both of you giving us some of your time. Just a couple of things that you deal with early on in the book before going on and talking a little bit about, you know, some of your ideas for what people should think about as they encounter the news. People have looked at these changes, that is, this big growth in sources of information and just how quickly information gets out there. And they have said a couple of things. One, some people have said, well, this is really great. What we're now getting to is a kind of pure information democracy. There are other people who say, this is a disaster. As you put it in the book, we're now in a world without editors, of unfettered spin, where the loudest or most agreeable voice wins and where the truth is the first casualty. So, but the two of you say, well, you think maybe either of those points is maybe a little bit too extreme. Where do you think we are?
Well, yeah, that's I think we're exactly where you described. This, as with every change in technology, every advance in technology of communication, we've gone through periods of disruption like this because when you democratize, engage more people in the information flow, you're going to have dislocation because you're going to hear new voices with new ideas and new backgrounds and new knowledge bases feeding into the system. Now we have the largest audience for the information flow that the world has ever seen. And with all those voices, there is going to be a lot of disorganization and disruption. It takes a while. It takes a decade, sometimes longer, to adjust to these changes. But the adjustment is already happening now. The mainstream media The old gatekeepers are adjusting to crowdsourcing, and the new journalism that's developing out in the grassroots by bloggers is beginning to adjust to the complicated issue of how you get verified information into the system.
Mm-hmm. And, David, I would add, add to that, that if you go to some of the new media systems, you'll see more curation, more vetting. Even Wikipedia, which a lot of people obviously are familiar with, they've set up a seniority system of editors so that it's harder for people to manipulate Wikipedia than it was when they began. Mm-hmm. So one system is moving more towards a kind of editing process, and the closed mainstream press is beginning to move to open up slightly. So, you know, in the end, is this a good or bad? I would say yes. there will be new strengths to this system from the openness and the colloquy, and there'll be more argument and more confusion and more ability for those who want to manipulate to spin it. And so the process of truth will be noisier and more chaotic.
The primary disruption has been one of economics. The economics that underwrote the old gatekeepers, the aggregators of verified information, has broken down. And finding an economic model that supports the kind of careful journalism that the greater public needs is the $64 question. Yeah. Now.
Well, I think that you say something that really strikes me as important and, again, a big challenge for news organizations in this section in the book where you talk about the future. And that is that on the one hand, news organizations that have been working in a certain way for a long time and presenting through one particular means for a long time, presenting their work, they're going to have to learn how to do this in different ways, as we say, across different platforms, which means that newsrooms are going to need a different mix of people. Now young people who are thinking about being journalists are going to have sets of skills that previous generations did not have to have. At the same time, you're arguing that news organizations are going to have to really hold on to many of their traditional roles, the traditional watchdog role, the traditional role that says when someone in authority says this is the way the world is, it's our responsibility or the media's responsibility to say, well, wait a minute, is that really what it is? So this, I think, is actually it means that the role for media should, rather than shrinking, it's expanding. And I think that's going to be a real challenge for a lot of news organizations to decide, particularly in view of the kind of economic circumstances that you were just talking about. It's going to be a real challenge for them to figure out how to do this, how to do what they were doing before, and yet how to do this new thing and how to do it all.
Yeah. The responsibilities of the press, what we require of them in a larger sense, hasn't changed. The way they fulfill those responsibilities is changing drastically. And for instance, not long ago, I think many journalists would have said that journalism is storytelling. It's writing narratives. Well, if your website simply is limited to text narratives and avoids databases and interactives that allow the consumer to answer their own questions, is not responding to consumer or audience input, is not using audio, not using video, not using databases, then you're going to be really a century behind in the kind of journalism and information that you're making available. In a user-controlled media culture, the press needs to provide tools and opportunities for the user to take control over some of their consumption.
Yeah, if you look at one of the most important roles organized journalism, traditional journalism has ever done, was bearing witness. By being there to observe and to watch people in institutions of power in action and discuss and describe the actions they were taking for the rest of the people. The best old-line news organizations with interactive connection with the entire public in their community has the opportunity in trying to develop a system of crowdsourcing where they have individual citizens who can do the provide the watch over those institutions and feed that through their communication system. A number of public radio stations do that now.
We have a caller that I'd like to bring into the conversation, and then for the benefit of anyone who's just tuned in the last few minutes, perhaps I should introduce again our guests, Bill Kovich and Tom Rosensteel. They're together are the authors of the book Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. It's published by Bloomsbury. They also have authored two other books, The Elements of Journalism and also Warp Speed, that deal with some of these same issues. This is a book, I think it's more for a general audience, although it'd be wouldn't be a bad thing for young journalists or aspiring journalists to read. It's out now in the bookstore. Questions are welcome. We have somebody here who's ready to go, and others can join us too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Montgomery, and it's on our toll free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I want to say happy Thanksgiving first before I get started. So I hope everybody has a good turkey day.
Sure.
You know, I've been getting more, the older you get, the more into politics you seem to get. And I've been in helping a friend of mine the last couple of years out, the last couple of probably 10, 12 years, run for office. And there are a lot of blogs out there, and it isn't just being politicians, but there's a lot of conspiracy theorists out there that like to put things out without looking at the facts, and people just don't know where to go. I mean, I could go on, as obvious, Craigslist is one. There's a, I forget the other one, Facebook's another one. You don't know who's at the other end. Anything that comes significant as far as information, like environmental issues, for instance, there's a lot of people that like to put their opinion towards the issue that they're talking about or writing about. And that's my concern, because I do firmly believe that sways an audience per votes, or, you know, just the issue of the truth about the information. How do you know? How do you really know who's at the other end, who's doing that job that is telling you the truth? That to me, is my question there. I mean, how do you screen people to know that they're telling you the truth without you doing the research on top of that?
Well, that's really the question that the book, I think, is trying to help with. How do you know? How do you evaluate where this information is coming from?
Yeah, and we, in the book, offer what we identify as six basic questions that you ask. I think the first thing to understand is that a question or an argument could come from a source, and even if you don't like that source, that doesn't disqualify what they're suggesting. If they've raised good questions, they're good questions. For instance, when CBS had questions raised about the memos that that concerned President Bush's National Guard service, the questions were raised by partisan websites that were very pro-Bush and anti-Kerry at the time. It was in the middle of an election. But that the partisan nature of the sources didn't mean that the questions that they asked about whether CBS had really verified and vetted the memos that they were basing their reporting on weren't good questions. So what we try and do in the book is say, okay, so what sorts – how do you assess – the evidence of a piece of material rather than just saying, well, I don't like that source, I don't like that website, I'm going to discount it entirely. And that begins with first asking, okay, what is this? is this a blog that's partisan? Is it a more traditional news source? Is it a kind of cable news where people can come on and say what they want to say fairly quickly without being challenged very much? We explain sort of the current landscape of media. And then you move on to more substantive questions such as, what's missing here? What questions are not answered by this account? Third question is, what sources are cited for this information? The next question is, what evidence is offered by those sources? And we walk pretty systematically through things like sources and evidence. For instance, people say, well, what sources? Well, there's many levels of source. There's a source who's a direct eyewitness, and then there's a source who's an expert witness. Then there's a source who's a participant but not a direct witness. In law, we identify the nature of someone to the event very carefully. A direct eyewitness can testify, but somebody who's secondhand cannot. In journalism, we're much fuzzier about that, and we try and bring some of that legal rigor to how you would evaluate information even as a consumer. It sounds daunting, but actually once you get into it and get into that process, it becomes a kind of interesting puzzle. It's not as hard to do as you think, and it's what editors have done in newsrooms for a long time. And I was a reporter. Bill was an editor. So I can tell you that from my point of view, editors aren't always rocket scientists. If they can do it, I think anybody can do it.
But you know, it's almost instinctive when you start when you think about it. If you look at the questions that Tom just described that you go through, the first thing you always do when you're confronted with an assertion, whether it comes from a friend or from a stranger, someone who's asserting a fact, the first thing you ask for in your mind, if not openly, is how do you know that? I mean, what's the source of that information? And once the source is made clear, you have something to judge. Well, is that a trustworthy source? I mean, is that a source that should know what they're talking about? Is it a documented source? Or, oh, yeah, I know that person, and I know they're in a situation to understand these things. They're the same kinds of questions that you generally go through. You know, when you're confronted with a new situation, it's just a matter of creating the steps in your own mind that you have to go through almost every time now, because you're going to find fact and fiction mixed together in almost any source of information you go to today.
Imagine that there's a crowd on the street and there's fire trucks and stuff like that, and you walk up to somebody, you stand there on the sidewalk and you say, you know what's going on? And they say, I heard there's a bomb threat. And you think, well, he said he heard there was a bomb threat. I don't know that this guy really knows. So you go and maybe ask a fireman. And the fireman says something that sounds a little vague, but it's a little more but you're more likely to trust what the fireman said because of fireman. But you realize this fireman's just standing next to me. He's not very close, and he's basically he's in crowd control. He's not at the event either. You know, so we're always capable of doing this, but we tend not to. We tend to be a lot more credulous and a lot more taking the word of people we like when it comes to traditional media, particularly about politics, I think.
Yeah. I think what makes this what has made this more difficult, and this is something that you address in this very first step that you outline, when you say to people, well, first of all, you have to ask yourself, well, what is this that I am seeing? That is, what sort of animal is this that I'm looking at? And that for a long time, we had, particularly in big news organizations, we had what you call the journalism of verification. And say you could take something like the New York Times. You can say all you want about the New York Times and what kind of biases it has and what kind of stories it's missed. At least at the paper, like at a big paper like that, what they're trying to do is they're trying to be right. They're trying to be careful in their sources, their established ways they have of going about collecting and presenting the information. Reporters collect it, but then editors say to them, okay, you tell me how you know this. And they're trying to do things in a certain kind of a way. Well, we also have more recent kind of models, like in cable news, for example, where maybe the important thing to them is getting the story out first, putting out as much stuff as possible as fast as they can. And then we have news organizations that are courting a particular kind of viewer with a particular point of view. Those things are relatively new, but they're in the mix now. And I think that those having those forums, they have made it much more, this business of trying to decide what it is that I'm getting, how to evaluate that, they've made that much more complicated.
Yeah, they have done that, but they've also given you the first step in the process of gathering your own news report. And it allows you quickly to decide what it is you have to look for. In the journalism of verification, they've got their sources, they're transparent, they identify the sources, they describe how they're in a position to know. If they don't, it's not a journalism of verification. It may be a faux journalism of verification. But if it's a journalism of assertion, which is reporting an incident the minute it happens, before the facts are fully known, you immediately are on guard and waiting to hear how they describe the situation.
We just lost the connection that we had with our guests. My apologies about that. Hopefully we can get that reestablished. We were talking to them through something that we call ISDN that gives us this really fine, high-quality connection. It makes it sound like they're with us in the studio, but they're not. So we hope to get that reestablished, and maybe it'll just give me the opportunity to introduce again the guests, which I probably should do because we're getting close to the halfway point. We're talking this morning with Bill Kovach and Tom Rosenstiel. Bill Kovach is former chief of the New York Times Washington Bureau. He served as editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He directed the Nieman Fellowship Program at Harvard University. He is the founding chairman of the Committee of Concerned Journalists and also senior counselor for the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Tom Rosenstiel, he's been a journalist for more than 30 years. He was media critic for the LA Times, chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek. He also was press critic for MSNBC's News with Brian Williams. In 1996, he founded the Project for Excellence in Journalism. That's a think tank that studies the press and is part of the Pew Research Center in Washington. Together, the two of them have authored now three books, The Elements of Journalism, The book Warp Speed, and also the one that's just out now that we're talking about, the title is Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. That book is published by Bloomsbury Press. So we have a couple of callers here we will try to get to in just a moment, and we see if we can get our connection reestablished. If you'd like to join us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think we have the guests back again. Bill, Tom, are you there?
Yeah, Bill's here. Tom's gone out a minute, but I'm here.
Okay. Okay, well, good. I'm glad at least I have one of you.
Okay. Right.
And I tell you what, why don't we just go, we have a telephone caller here, and why don't we go ahead and talk with them and see if we can get us back on track here. The caller is here where we are in Champaign County and line one. Hello.
Hi. Well,
yes.
It's a shame, but things happen like that, I guess. I'd like to get the Rosenstiel on this, too. This is a little complicated, and I don't know how much it has to do with new technologies. I guess it's more of a complaint about major media. And to make a specific example is the news stories around Aung San Suu Kyi's and the fake election in Burma and all that stuff. But I guess she's one of the most cited people from the Congress floor from when people are talking. This is a little complicated, but what I am frustrated with is that you can find reliable sources on the internet to verify what I'm going to say, which is that people complain about a lot of what's going on is people complaining about China propping up Burma. On the other hand, you hear very little coverage of Chevron, which bought Unocal, and Halliburton involved in the Adana pipeline. I was following at the time. It was a slave pipeline. Halliburton had the offshore part of it. It's a gas pipeline that directs gas to provide, I think, electricity for about a third of the capacity of Thailand. So it's a big thing. It's one of the things that's keeping the generals in power in Burma. We hear a lot of complaints about the Chinese trade with Burma and the failure of sanctions. But it's public record that Unocal was given a waiver to have this commerce, and there's just very little comment on it. And it just seems I can't understand. Well, it doesn't serve the powers that be for the media to report something that ties in with the whole discussion of energy policy. You know, might have implications for other parts of South Central Asia. So it just, and I know it's a broader issue than perhaps what Blur is about, but both the guests are media analysts, and I just, you know, can you react to that kind of critique of what I regard as a servile major media? Then when they don't cover it, the discourse that I give gets marginalized, and people don't take it as seriously. But it's really the you know, like the newspaper record, the Times, just not regarding that as a reasonable story. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe people know about this and have seen it, but it's not commonly cited as one of the factors in that that particular circumstance.
Well, we can trying to get some comment. Go ahead.
Well, I think the caller raises a really interesting issue that's broader, as he indicates, than just the specific question he's raising, which is how does an issue that is important but isn't getting a lot of coverage, how do we make that a more important part of the agenda? Well, it goes back to the sort of, is this a better or a more troubled world? And the answer is a little of both. On the one hand, he can raise those he has more ability to raise those concerns and shape the agenda and find other citizens who are also concerned and make their interest known than ever before. He also has the ability to find sources who are covering those issues. They may be European or even English language, or perhaps not even English language sources, and to take that material and make it viral, to post it in social network settings and to put it on the agenda as well. On the other hand, it's also true that whether it's the New York Times or CBS News or any other traditional mainstream source, they have changed in two fundamental ways. First, they are not necessarily ordering the news anymore by significance. As we say in the book, the front page meeting of the New York Times is no longer, as it once was, a decision about what are the six most important events of the day, and they'll be on the front page. The page is designed to amass audience and not simply order the news, because they're struggling for audience along with everyone, you know, they're competing with everyone else. And the second thing is that these large news institutions don't have the news gathering capacity that they had 25 or 30 years ago. The networks have essentially eliminated most of their foreign bureaus. The New York Times still has its foreign bureaus, but most other newspapers, with the exception of two or three in the United States, no longer have foreign staffs. And so shaping the news agenda is something of a dialogue, and often a fractious one, that goes on between the audience and the news reporters. And we can't lean back and expect the press to do it on our behalf without our being engaged in shaping it. Mm-hmm.
And if I could add specifically to this caller, one way the system works in his favor, if he wants to work it that way, is that the years that I was running the Nieman program at Harvard, I had some of the best journalists I had were students or from Indonesia and Malaysia. And they're all working for news organizations that have English language websites. They're doing good reporting out there. And if you go to their websites and see the information you think should be in the news organization reports emanating here in the United States, you can pass that information that you get there on to them in the form of a letter or a blog to the editor. And most good news organizations are paying more attention to those and giving them more space. And you can become, in effect, an aggregator of information that you send to your other source to try to get them to pay attention to something that's not being covered in their basic news report.
It's more of a hassle, but the net product in the end may be better. But it is definitely more of a hassle. It's more of of the consumer leaning forward and being engaged.
Just to take further the point of the caller, and again, we are maybe getting a little bit off of the intent of the book, but I'm interested in what you would have to say. That some people, I think, would say that one of the problems with the news media today is that they are big businesses, sometimes part of very big corporations. They're expected to make money. To the extent that they have stockholders, they expect a return on their investment. And that kind of pressure is greater than it has ever been before, and that affects the content and the stories that they choose to cover. Do you think that that's true?
Yes, and I think that that's actually a major factor why big media are in the predicament that they are in, because they didn't do a lot of long-term planning and a lot of long-term strategy. They didn't invest in new and, frankly, sometimes risky experiments for the future because they were very focused on the next quarter and the next year, more so than they were in an earlier era when profits were easier. They were viewed by Wall Street as a mature industry, an industry that wasn't really going to grow its audience very much anymore in the face of new technology, and so it should manage costs. And that's what traditional media has done. As a consequence of that, many opportunities that could have been developed by the news industry and that would have subsidized new news gathering were let go, were developed by competitors, whether it's Craigslist or Realtor.com or online job listings and a host of other. We could have a whole conversation for an hour about opportunities missed. But now they're in a position where they're not making significant profits from news, and they're trying to somehow reinvent themselves on the margins. And that's a more difficult task because, ironically, they were focused on the short term over the last generation rather than taking a long-term strategic point of view.
All right. Let's talk with another caller here in the community nearby in Savoy, line one. Hello.
Good morning. I have two questions. The first one has two parts. I hope David can help you all remember the second one because you're liable to forget it by the time you get done with the two-part first question. The two-part first question basically is, do you know what year and who it was that had the power to decide that the New York Times would change its approach to the six top articles for the front page, et cetera? And the other part of that is, were they first to do that, or did they follow after a bunch of other newspapers did that? And the second question is, how did it come to pass that the writer of the article does not get to select his own or her own title for the article? I have seen multiple instances where the title for the article does not match. It gives you the opposite, sometimes, impression of what the article is going to be than what the author really did write up his little journalism article. And with that, I'll get off it. Are my questions clear?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, bye.
All right.
The shift at the New York Times occurred, I can't recall the exact year, but it occurred in a remake of the look of the front page of the newspaper, and that was a design decision. It was not a decision made to put fewer stories on the front page. It was to display them better, and as it turned out, the only way you could do that was to reduce the number of stories on the front page. It did not reduce the number of stories in the Daily Report. The Daily Report had the same number of stories in the A section or the basic news section that it had before the redesign occurred. It just made the front page look more open and not as cluttered, which may have been a smart move and may not have been. And the second part of the question, reporters in modern times have never written the headlines on their stories. They've always been written by an editor who tried to digest the basic importance of the story and reduce it to a few letters. Most reporters had no idea how to count a headline, and if they had to, it would have taken twice as long to get the story into paper. So you had a desk that had specialists in how many letters you could get in a line of type in a headline. Both of those were mechanical decisions, and at the time they were made, they have nothing to do really with the content. Headlines are, I guess, every other headline I read, I think, is not as good as one I would have written after I've read the story. So I'm not sure you could ever write a perfect headline.
David, we may have missed the second part of the first question, but I can't remember what it is.
Well, I think he was asking this question about the point that you raised about the paper, the New York Times, and how they decided that they were going to present the news and how many stories each day were they going to present and so forth. So he was interested in who decided that and when that happened at the Times, but also he was asking, well, was the Times out front in doing that, or did some other newspaper, say, do that, and then the Times looked at that and said, well, we should be patterning ourselves after them?
I think USA Today started that whole redesign push when Al Newhart decided that he needed a front page that looked like a television screen and created a more open front page with a lot of art and a lot of color. Virtually every other newspaper in the country fell in line over the next decade, and that would have been the decade of the 70s. 80s.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, one other thing I would point to is that there were larger forces here that were influencing this. The New York Times became a newspaper that was no longer just distributed in New York City. It was competing for readers nationwide. And when the Times did it, it said, okay, well, now we're a second newspaper, a supplemental newspaper for people. USA Today was always a supplemental newspaper. It wasn't the hometown newspaper anywhere. And then newspapers across the country after USA Today was launched in 1981 said, you know what, Newhart's right about one thing. We're competing with television. We're competing with all kinds of other media, and we need to sort of figure out how to do that. We can't simply say there are certain people in the world who are newspaper readers and we own them. So there were larger forces here. One of the interesting things, David, that I think we sometimes don't recognize is that online, we go back to a different era. Online, you don't have 6 stories. You might have 100 stories on the front page of a website. And if you look at Yahoo News, you can organize that the way you want. And their top stories, in many ways, really are the most important stories, or at least as Yahoo's editors imagine it. So you have more power as a consumer now to find what you're looking for, even on a homepage. It's also true, though, that many people don't actually get their news by going to the homepage. They get it by, 40% of American adults say they now get news sent to them by, or that they get news that they follow on social networks, their friends or the institutions that they like. Recommend stories to them, and that's how they get their news. So we have new news authorities that are different than the front page editors in the New York Times. Mm.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. I think I probably should introduce the guests again. Tom Rosensteel, he's the last voice that you heard. Also with us is Bill Kovach. Both of them are journalists. Bill was chief of the New York Times Washington Bureau, also served as editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tom Rosenstiel, he was media critic for the Los Angeles Times, chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek. He's the founder of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. That's a think tank that studies the press. It's part of the Pew Research Center in Washington. And Bill is also involved in that organization. He's senior counselor for the Project for Excellence in Journalism. The two of them together, the authors of the book Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. It's recently published by Bloomsbury. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of your points, the ultimate point, the sixth point, is that you suggest people, as they are looking at the news, however they get it, ask themselves this question, am I learning what I need? And it seems that on one level, that's not actually an easy question. It's actually a hard question to answer. And I'm thinking about something that often is pointed to, something that in the psychology business they call confirmation bias, which is this tendency, I think, that maybe all of us have to one extent or another, as we're going around through the world, picking up bits of data that confirm what it is we already think. Now, actually, I'm somewhat comforted by somewhere in the book here that you note that you think actually it's maybe not as bad as we think, and that people are indeed going beyond what it is they know, at least to some extent. Do you think that there's reason to believe that?
Well, if you look at, I mean, it's people often say, "Wait, now everybody just gets their news from sources they agree with." You know, everybody's getting their news from either Fox or MSNBC. The data tell a different story. The most popular destinations online are portals and aggregators of very conventional wire service, traditional journalism. Yahoo News is the most popular news source online, followed by MSNBC.com, AOL, and CNN. And the content there is very conventional. The first newspaper, which is the fourth most visited site online for news, is the New York Times. Hmm. You have to go down a ways until you get to more partisan sources. So the audience for conventional journalism is still, and even in new media, very high and far higher in aggregate than the audience for partisan sources. But I don't, you know, there's, I think the confirmation bias, where what people think about these facts that they acquire, is a powerful thing, and it's a challenge in this new environment when we move fairly quickly from initial facts to interpretive conversation about what those facts mean or how to act on them. And that's why I think you see the rise of cable, primetime cable hosts, talk radio, some popular bloggers, and others. The discussion component of our media culture is growing, and that's a good thing, but it certainly makes the confirmation bias more powerful.
I think you've touched on one of the problems that that we really need to be concerned about. The most recent research I've seen deals with the fact that so many of the websites now, in order to try to keep people's eyeballs on the website, are asking questions of them, and on many of the stories, asking their opinion of the story either before the story runs or immediately after. And the research shows pretty clearly that any person reading a bit of information or watching a bit of information about which they've been asked to form an opinion very quickly quit collecting information and worrying about what their opinion is of what they've just read.
Hmm. One of the things that you point to, and it's certainly, I think, really stunning, is the, you know, to the extent to which now people have access to news virtually anywhere if they have a smartphone or if they have some sort of mobile device, and more people do. So they have access to news anywhere, anytime. that it seems that we're just carrying forward the this trend that we've seen, and it really started with CNN, of 24-hour news, of having to put news out there and having to continually fill the airwaves with news.
Yeah.
The problem, one of the problems that attaches to that is that when something is happening, when you have a big breaking story, you're riding it, and you know there's very little opportunity to stand back, at least for a few moments, and say, wait a minute, what is going on here? What is the story? What are we seeing? Trying to organize the material, trying to do some verification, trying to get an understanding so that then you can present that to people. It's become more and more difficult to do that because of this pressure to get it out there, get it out there first, and keep getting it out there. And it seems that with this opportunity for people to get news with mobile devices anytime, that just makes that just pushes that even further than it did before. Does that concern you at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's we get our news iteratively, piecemeal. Think of all the information that bombarded us about, let's say, the healthcare debate. And then at the end, how many people know what the healthcare law will do? If you get sort of random pieces of information, some of which may be true, or some of which may be helpful, and some of which may be untrue and unhelpful, you've collected a lot of facts, but not a lot of knowledge. And that is really one of the great challenges. In the era of information overload, knowledge is harder to create because you have to sift through more piecemeal, random bits of information to make sense of things. Eric Schmidt said earlier this year that the CEO of Google, that more data is created, more information is created every 3 days now in the year 2010 than was created from the beginning of human civilization to the year 2003, every 3 days. Now, not every tweet or blog or newspaper story is equivalent in value to the creation of fire. And this is the problem that we have in the iterative piecemeal news environment.
Yeah, and the first news organization that figures out how to authenticate information in that flow and aggregate the best is going to be the one that wins the race for the largest audience, because the public needs that help and they're waiting for it.
Is there anybody that you think is right now is doing a particularly good job at trying to do that?
Well, I think the New York Times website is one of the more powerful websites in terms of information and aggregating material that they believe has been authenticated and demonstrates it. I think the other large traditional news organizations are building those sites. There's an experiment going on in your town with the Chicago Tribune, and it's going to be interesting to see how that turns out as it begins to focus its coverage more on local and less on international and national. I know there's some complaints about that. I'm sure there are. But that's an enormous city with a lot of interesting and powerful and useful information that often goes uncovered. And it's going to be interesting to see what the reaction is to that movement. Mm.
David, I would say that nobody's sort of got the mix yet. One big issue is that monetizing or making money from the web hasn't been figured out, and we may be several years away from that. I think the most exciting thing that we are seeing now is engagement with the audience as a community of knowledgeable people who can make the journalism product better. Minnesota Public Radio was a great innovator in this with their Public Insight Network, which is a fancy name for basically identifying their community of listeners and identifying their skill sets and their knowledge of and their areas of expertise and knowledge, and then activating that network when they were going out to do stories. The Guardian in England calls the same idea mutualization, and they've engaged their audience in their news gathering in any number of dazzling sort of ways, where the audience member is not just a receiver of the information but is actually an active contributor. It's different than citizen bloggers, because you may actually be asked by the news organization, we're working on a story about X, Y, and Z. Has anybody had any experience with this? And if you have, you then contact the news organization in a private space, not by publicly blogging to them, and their news gathering becomes better. We're seeing a lot of examples of that, or examples of visual representation of data. The New York Times, I think, is good at that. Is there a place where you can say, well, they've cracked the code? No. But there are a lot of interesting experiments here and there that suggests that the newsrooms, at least, are beginning to become excited by the potential of the digital age rather than defensive about it.
Yeah. I think just as a way of wrapping up, and we're at the point where we're going to have to finish, I think you put it very nicely in just one sentence, that the relationship now between the news media and the consumer of news, it's no longer a lecture. It is now a dialogue. Having said that, though, figuring out what exactly that means, that's the big challenge, and how
and
you
it,
do that.
And it involves responsibility on the part of the consumer and new responsibilities on the part of the journalists.
I think you're going to try to get in on that comment, Bill?
No, I think you're exactly right. I mean, it is a two-way relationship now, and I think that's the most important part of it. I think the opportunity for a news organization to forge a one-to-one relationship with thousands of people in their audience is the most exciting possibility that journalism has ever had.
A good book here for people who are thinking about these issues to look at. It's titled Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. It's published by Bloomsbury by our guests Bill Kovach and Tom Rosensteel. And Bill Kovach, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks
and,
for having me.
And Tom Rosensteel, thank you.
Thanks, David.